Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's fantastic to have your company for another episode of the show. Now, if you are a motivated and driven practice owner and you want to get more from your practice and more from your life, come and join us in the Savvy Dentist Facebook group, because in there you're going to find we've got some tools, some training that are going to help you on your journey to practice success. Whatever it is you're looking to achieve, there'll be something there for you. Now, in this episode, we're going to be talking about creating a successful practice, because in particular, I want to talk about how to create a practice and a life that you love. So I want to go through a five-step scaling framework that I teach our high-end mastermind clients. And this episode is really brought about because I received an email from a dentist the other day. I'm going to call him Steve. That's not his real name. I don't want to reveal his identity. But what Steve wrote to me was really distressing, but I also really related to it. Steve runs a successful dental practice. He's making good money. He's got good patient flow. He generally enjoys his dentistry to an extent. But what's actually happening is that he is working harder and harder and harder. And what he's seeing is that he's staying back late after work. He'll be doing dentistry during the working day. He'll stay back after work to maybe write some referrals or review cases or maybe even meet with the team. And then what's been happening for Steve is he's been getting home later, and that's having an impact on his personal life. It's having an impact on his relationships at home. It's having an impact on his relationships with himself. So he's not taking care of himself. He can't fit himself into his own day anymore. And on top of that, he's missing things with his young kids. He's got two young kids, and he feels like he's missing out. And so he's always feeling like he's choosing. He's either having to choose to be at home with his family and then feel guilty about not doing the work that he needs to do, or if he's at work, he feels guilty for missing out on those family things. And he wrote to me in a deal of distress, asking me for some thoughts and for some advice on how to get out of that. Now, I want to tell you, I have been in those shoes. When I had my first dental practice, I had a practice very similar to what Steve spoke about. Good money, lots of patients, working too long hours. And what ends up happening is when you're in that situation is you run out of energy at some point and your effectiveness diminishes, your returns decrease, and essentially the practice runs the risk at least of going into decline. So I wanted to talk about how to interrupt that pattern, how to break that cycle. And I want to share with you really the process of scaling up. Now, before I get to the process itself, you'll remember that there's really three levels of growth in a practice, maybe even four if you talk about starting up. But beyond starting up, you've really got a place where you're focusing on growth, and that level is really designed to drive profitability of your practice. Then there's a scaling level, and then there's, of course, the value where you're creating enterprise value. And so we talk about profitable, scalable, and valuable. Now, to go from a profitable practice like the one Steve has and like the one I had in my first practice, there's some shifts that need to occur. It's not about working harder. It's about re-engineering the business model. It's about working in slightly different ways, focusing on slightly different areas, but getting vastly different results. Now, I didn't figure this out early in the piece. I've got to tell you that I did the traditional practice management program that is still around today, and it taught me how to have a job in my practice. And now, if that's you and that's what you like, that's totally cool. There's nothing wrong with that. If you like operating that way, then this episode's probably not for you. But what I found is I didn't want to operate that way, and I'd ignored all my previous business instincts and followed what I thought was the right way for dentistry. And in actual fact, it was the wrong way for me. It was the wrong way for me because I wanted to have a practice that gave me the money and the time and the fulfillment rather than just money. And so, yes, I acknowledge that making a financial return on your practice is very important. Of course it is. We get that, right? But I didn't want that and nothing else. I wanted my cake and I wanted to eat it too. So this episode is for those that want the cake and eat it too. So let's get into this five-step framework. So the first step is really to have a good strategic plan. Now, a strategic plan sounds simple, but there's a lot of depth in there. So the elements of a strategic plan include being really clear about where you are now, being clear-eyed about what the current state of play is. You've got to know what's working and what's not. Now, we've got to be able to address that objectively rather than emotionally. We want to be able to assess whether our systems are holding up, whether our team is on board. We've got to analyze the team. We've got to figure out whether they are a great fit for our culture, and whether they're performing well in their roles. We've got to be able to look at our goals as well and be really clear about what we're trying to optimize our practice for. Because if we're not clear about what the outcome is, then we're not going to really get there. And what I see happen a lot of times for dentists is they just want something other than what they've got, and they don't specify what that other than is. And so we've got to get as much clarity around that as possible. And we call that a vivid vision. We want to be really clear in as much detail as possible, as much technicolor as we can conjure up to, you know, really fill in the gaps around that vision. We want to have good clarity, not just from a metrics point of view. Of course, we want to know what our earnings are going to be, how much time we're going to work in the practice, and all of those sorts of things. Very clear to have those metrics in place. But we also want to understand what that's going to give us. Why is that important to us? Why are we attaching ourselves to those things? So we've got to get emotionally connected to that vision. When we achieve this, how will we feel? What will that mean? What's the outcome for that? Any strategic plan needs to identify some milestones and markers along the way for, you know, on the journey from where you are to where you want to get to. You've got to have some milestones and markers, and we need to be able to put some flags in the ground so that we know that we're on track and we're making progress. And, you know, I liken that to a train track. You know, if you're going from one station to the next, the train's got to run to time. And if it's not running to time, or if it's going in the wrong direction, then we've got some problems. But any good strategic plan will also identify risk. And risk is a really important thing. We've got to identify what could disrupt our future stream of earnings. We've got to identify what could derail our plans, and we've got to put some risk mitigation strategies in there. So when you're looking at risks, firstly, you want to go through the process of identifying them and then quantifying them, meaning like how likely is that risk to occur? What would be the severity of that event should it occur? And then putting in place some carefully crafted risk mitigation strategies around that. And so when you're thinking about your strategic plan, it really is your North Star. It's designed to come back to over and over again. It's designed to make sure that you are holding yourself to account and not wandering off on all different manner of paths, which can happen very candidly when you're busy with stuff. So we always want to be coming back to this strategic plan. So that is step number one of our five-step framework. This is the Savvy Dentist Scaling Up Framework. So step number one is strategy. Step number two, though, is about building assets. It's important to understand that income always follows assets. If you look at a balance sheet, it's the assets that generate your income. And what I'd share with you is that every headache, frustration, or bottleneck can be sourced back to a deficiency of assets. Now, that phrase, that comment, I learned from a fellow called Glenn Carlson, who's been on this podcast a couple of times, and I'd encourage you to go back and listen to those episodes. But every asset in your practice is designed to be turned into cash flow. Now, there's four types of assets in your practice broadly. There's your intellectual property assets, your ways of doing business, your systems, your processes, the how we do business kind of things. You've got your team as an asset, and how you are able to utilize that team and get them skilled up is going to be a key asset. Of course, there's the physical assets. There's the plant and equipment, the chairs, the compressor, the suction, the materials, all those sorts of things. And then, of course, you've got your patient base as an asset as well. And as I said, our whole role as a business owner is to be able to take those assets in our practice and firstly convert that to revenue. Once we've converted the asset to revenue, we want to take that revenue and convert it to profit, and then ultimately to free cash flow. Now, how effective we are as business owners of taking our assets and turning them into free cash flow is a measure of efficiency. So we've always got to be turning these assets into cash flow. And once you've turned them into cash flow, you've got a couple of options. The first option is to take that cash flow and either pay yourself a dividend as the owner, which is fine. The second option is to reduce any debt and borrowing you have, which I think is always good. Managing your debt levels is very prudent. You've got to be able to make sure that you don't have excessive amounts of debt. Debt is a bit like fire. You know, it can burn you and it can warm you. And there's times to take on debt and there's times to pay down debt. Obviously, when interest rates are low, people tend to borrow more, but conversely, it's also a good time to pay down debt because you're not paying too much interest. You can get that principal paid back very, very quickly. So you could use your cash flow to reduce debt levels. The third option when it comes to your cash flow, once you've converted your assets to cash flow, is to take some of that cash flow and buy more assets. So maybe it's about adding another chair in, maybe it's about adding another team member in, whatever it happens to be, it's about converting the asset all the way through to cash flow and then using that cash flow wisely. Now, our job as practice owners is around resource allocation. So we've got to make sure we're using our resources effectively, as I said, to turn those assets into cash and then to use that cash wisely. So that's step number two. Now, step number three is to create a self-managing team. As we move from a profitable practice to a scalable practice, we want to cross this thing called the leverage line. Now, in a profitable practice, it's really key person dependent. In a scaled practice, it's systems and team dependent. Now, the systems form part of the assets, the intellectual property assets, but the team part is very, very important. We've got to have what we call a self-managing team. So in my world, a self-managing team is a group of people that come to work, they know what to do, they know how to do it, they have the resources to do it, and on top of that, they have the internal drive to do it. So they come with what I call batteries included. And so if you want to have a business where you're not always the answer guy or girl and people coming to you for questions, you're going to need to create a self-managing team. That means we want to train your team to think like you. Now, the quickest way to train your team to think like you is when they come to you with a question seeking an answer is to not default to the position of always giving the answer. Because if you do that, you're training them to come to you for answers all the time. What you might want to do is say, well, what are the options? What else could we do? What risks do you see with that? What might you consider other than what we've spoken about? What do you think I'm thinking about? All of those sorts of things. We want to train your team to be thinking like you. Now, of course, building and leading a team is an art and a science, and we've got to understand that when we're starting to build this team, we've got to be able to recruit the very best people. And recruitment is marketing, and so we've got to understand that there's a whole lot of marketing going on for the very best talent. That means we need to be really clear about who our ideal applicant avatar is for any particular role. We've got to be really clear about our employer value proposition. Why should someone come and work with us, for example? And we've got to craft advertisements that actually speak to that ideal applicant avatar. We've got to speak to their hopes and aspirations. We've got to identify their fears and frustrations and craft an ad that helps them understand that we are the best place for them to avoid their fears and frustrations, but to achieve their hopes and aspirations. And once they're in the practice, we've got to be able to firstly onboard our people very well. We've got to set expectations really well. We've got to inculcate them with our culture, which means we need to know our values. We need to know the vision of the practice. We need to articulate the behavioral standards that we expect in our practice so that our values are lived every single day. And so we've got to be able to onboard people and set them up for success. My experience is that most people want to succeed in their role. My experience is that most people believe they succeed in their role. And where the disconnect occurs is typically when our expectations and their expectations don't line up. So the onboarding process is all about getting everyone on that same page. Now, of course, once we've onboarded people, we then need to have a training system. We need to have a process where we can have people become proficient in their role, build the skills that they need to be successful in their role. They may already have some great skills, but they may need to develop others. And we want to identify those skills gaps and put in place the relevant training resources around that. So this is, again, a bit of a blend between assets as well. We've got to have the training resources and we've got to have all of the onboarding resources, which form part of our intellectual property assets, as a way of getting our team members up to speed as quickly as possible. So what I liken this to is it's a bit like getting onto the freeway. You know, when you're the cars on the freeway are doing 100 or 110 kilometers an hour and you're on that little on-ramp, you've got to get up to speed pretty quickly so you can join the traffic. And that's really what we want for our team as well. So we've got to be able to recruit well, onboard well, train well, and then we've got to be able to manage well. And that means we've got to be able to really identify how people are tracking, how they're traveling. We've got to be able to mentor them, guide them, coach them so that they're continually improving along the way. That means we've got to have regular training sessions. That means we've got to have regular reviews. We've got to have scorecards in place so that they know what the goalposts look like. And as business owners, and indeed if you're a practice manager listening to this as well, there's really a couple of key conversations that you want to have in your tool belt to be able to help people fulfill their potential. You want to be able to demonstrate appreciation for a job well done, clearly. And there's several ways you can do that, but I like the five languages of appreciation style of methodology. You need to be able to have a necessary conversation, which is sometimes called a difficult conversation. I don't like the word difficult because I don't think it has to be difficult, but it's a conversation that sometimes people avoid. And if we avoid having conversations with people, it means that we don't address the things that need to be addressed. So then things can fester. And then every now and then, from time to time, and hopefully this is a rarity, we need to be able to elegantly have someone leave the practice. We need to move them on. Now, hopefully that's not too common, but we want to be able to do that in a way that maintains the dignity of the person involved, because they might not be a great fit for our practice, but they might be a perfect fit for another role in another business somewhere. And so it's not about good or bad people, it's just about fit. And so when it comes to building a self-managing team where we've got people who know what to do and how to do it, we always want to be leveling up the team. We always want to be growing the top of the tree and pruning the bottom of the tree. We want to be leveling the team up all the way through, everyone moving forward together. And to have a self-managing team, that's going to give you the time, freedom, the flexibility. So that means when Steve, if you're listening to this, mate, and I hope you are, that means having your team think like you, take action like you, take things off your plate is going to be key. Now, what really mucks that up, though, is dentists holding on to things. We tend to be control freaks a little bit, some of us. And that means that our ability to delegate is sometimes impeded. We all understand intellectually the value of delegation. I mean, you hear that in every management book, every management seminar, delegate, delegate, delegate. But why do so few people actually do it? Well, the reason they don't do it is because they're afraid of the result not being what they want. They're afraid of adverse outcomes reflecting on the practice or themselves. All those sorts of things play into the mind of the business owner. So if you're going to delegate, you want to set people up for success, which means you've got to train them to do the task, not just kind of hand it off. And equally, rather than delegating tasks, you want to also delegate decisions and outcomes. And that's the key difference. Most dentists delegate tasks, and that means the dentist is still holding things in their mind. What we want to be able to delegate is outcomes and decisions, and that's a key and fundamental difference. And we want to be able to have reporting mechanisms so that if that particular team member gets stuck or needs support and help, they can still come to us. But we're coaching them and guiding them, not telling them what to do. So that's step number three around a self-managing team. That will set you free. That will free up your time. Coupled with systems and the intellectual property assets that we spoke about a moment ago, that's going to create enormous amount of leverage in your day. It's going to create enormous amount of free time for you, and it's going to allow you to get out of the practice and have a bit more balance in your life. But of course, on top of that, we do need data. We need to make informed decisions. We need to make sure we're collecting the correct data, the relevant data, and that would include a series of leading indicators and lagging indicators. Leading indicators are typically activities that need to be undertaken in a practice to produce a result. Now, we know the 80-20 rule, such that 20% of the activities produce 80% of the outcomes. So we want to identify the 20% of the leading indicators or activities, we call those activities critical drivers, that produce 80% of the results. So we track leading activities as well as lagging results. And that's really, really important. On your dashboard, we know that if we're getting the results today, but we've stopped doing the activities, we know that in a little while, our results will suffer as well. So we've got to make sure of that. Now, as you scale up, an important metric you're going to need to be thinking about is capacity and capacity planning. This is really important. If you're looking to scale up and create more chairs under one roof or add new locations or whatever it is, you're going to need to be able to understand what your growth trajectory is. It means you need to understand what your scalable unit is. So it could be a chair, with X number of patients, a clinician and X number of support staff or whatever it happens to be. But when you're going through capacity planning, what you need to know is what your active patient numbers are now. We need to know what your rate of new patient growth is. We need to know what your patient churn rates are so that we can bring on resources in a timely manner. We can make sure that we're planning for future growth. We can make sure that we're able to expand and bring in new patients to the practice without exceeding our capacity limits. Because here's the thing, your practice will grow as far as your capacity allows it to. But as soon as you hit a capacity limit, you're going to restrict the growth of the practice. And if you want to scale up and create leverage, ultimately you want to have income coming from other people's hands beyond your own. And so you'll need a certain number of providers to be able to do that for you. So capacity planning is an important part of data management, along with dashboards and other things as well. And the fifth step in our framework is around execution. This will come as no surprise that the people who succeed most are the ones that actually get things done. It's not about talking about it. It's not about planning in isolation. Planning is important, of course, but we've got to be able to implement that plan. And so where I see a lot of people coming unstuck is they've got great ideas that they just don't deliver on, they don't execute on. And one of the reasons people don't execute on them is because they're just too busy. They're trying to do 10 things at once. So my suggestion as a key thing when it comes to executing your plans is to do one or two things, finish them before you take on the next things. The mistake I see is people doing 10 things at once, and it's like me throwing 10 tennis balls at you and expecting you to catch them. Something, if not all, is going to fall through the cracks. You'll drop the lot, and typically, you know, things don't get done. You just have a whole bunch of incomplete stuff. Now, typically, when you're looking at all the things you could do, the projects, the activities, or the tasks that need to be done, what we like to do is to filter those tasks or triage those tasks or projects using an impact and ease filter. So if you draw a quadrant, much like a dental quadrant, on the vertical axis, you put impact. On the horizontal axis to the right, you put ease. The things that are high impact and easy to do are the ones you'd put your energy into first. Now, easy could be that it is just straight out easy to do, or it could be that it's nearly complete and we want to just finish that off, right? So this is what we're talking about. We've got to be able to prioritize our implementation of projects, and we've got to be able to take on not too many things so that we don't get swamped and drowned in what we're going to do. So that's our five-step framework. So just once again to recap, it's about having a great strategic plan. It's about building assets. It's about building and leading a self-managing team. It's about using data to make informed decisions, and it's about priority execution. Now, if you can get these five things right in your practice, what you'll find is that your ability to earn continues to grow. You'll make more profit for sure. But that profit won't be reliant on you. And if you're looking to create a business that has value in the marketplace rather than just creating a job for yourself, if you want to have a business that has value, what we want for you as a practice owner is for your contribution to revenue to be progressively shrinking, meaning that we're having more leverage come through the system, meaning that income is being generated by other people beyond yourself. And so this is how to do it. So Steve, thank you so much for sending your email in. I hope you found this framework helpful and useful. And of course, jump into the Savvy Dentist Facebook group and we're happy to continue this conversation there. But in the meantime, have a great week, team. Lovely to talk to you as always. Take good care. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.